Jaguru, everybody.
Jaguru.
Jaguru.
Welcome to the fourth and final part of chapter two. We got there in quite quick succession, actually, for this chapter, but we do have a potential bonus episode to follow, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail toward the end of this episode. Really, we're at the end of a very magical chapter. Now, in this episode, we're going to dive into the finale of chapter two. So Paramahansa Yogananda's mother's message to young Mukunda, retelling a story of a strange sadhu and gifted her an amulet. Now, this in turn she gave to Paramahansa Yogananda, with specific instructions as to how and when to do so. So we're going to delve into all of that. And we'll finish the chapter, of course, by looking at how Paramahansa Yogananda responded to receiving the amulet, some of his reflections. We actually have a correction to do from the last episode. I'll get into that as well shortly. I suppose listeners, viewers, followers of the Yogananda podcast, if you do want to do some homework, what I would say in real time, if you are able to, you want to pause and read, please feel free to do so. So this episode will start from, it was an interview with a sage in the Punjab. So we're going to start from there. We're going to read. So if you want to read along, think about what talking points you would wish to discuss, feel free to suggest them in the comments. YouTube is a pretty good place to reach out to us. Mm-hmm. If you want to comment and say, maybe, you know, we missed something, or, you know, we could talk about something, add to the conversation. It'd be really nice to hear from you. We have so many people reaching out already. So thanks to those people who do, and, you know, I would encourage anybody else who hasn't to do so. It's really nice to hear from everybody. Alrighty. So that's what we can look forward to by and large in this episode. And we do want to recap, summarize the chapter at the end with some reflections on how we think this chapter has gone and our coverage of it, and what to look forward to in the next chapter. So all that said, let's kick off, shall we? So we can split this part into various aspects. So the first one, we think really we can talk about the sadhu, this sadhu, who the strange sadhu, as he was described, by looking really at the definition of it, essentially. So whilst Yogananda's family, they were living in Lahore, it says here that one morning, the servant that they had came in to talk to Yogananda's mother, and he said that he was insistent really on seeing the mother of Mukunda. So that was how he requested to be in the presence of Yogananda's mother. Now the message that she was to go to see the sadhu struck a profound chord within her, and we'll talk about that. But let's first look at the very beginning. The first talking point that we have is the sadhu and sages. This word sages is mentioned as well. And I suppose starting on this journey, I didn't really know what sage was or sadhu was. And, you know, I kind of thought, well, it's a kind of yogi or a type of, you know, character that devotes their life to God or something like this. But a sage for definition as such is a profound philosopher. You can find this online. Essentially, it's distinguished for wisdom, a mature or venerable person of sound judgment. And a sadhu, there's a male and female version, which is kind of cool. I wanted to mention sadhu is male, but if you're female sadhu, you're a sadvi, which is really, really nice. And it's a sadhu is a religious ascetic or a holy person in Hinduism. But it's also known in Buddhism, Jainism. They are essentially people who renounce the worldly life, and they're sometimes alternatively referred to as a yogi. So that's where maybe the confusion I had, that is indeed true. And then sometimes Yeah, it's pronounced all differently. So, sorry, Mike, you had your hand up. Do you want to jump in?
No, I just thought before we started all this, I thought sage was a type of herb, but then I was correct.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. To non-native speakers of English, you would be forgiven if you thought sage was an herb as well, because it is. It is. That's in the context of what we're talking about today. Sage is a distinguished person of wisdom. So yeah, some cool kind of ideas there. And to kind of delve into it a little bit further, if I can, like, if again, you're wondering what somebody who's a religious ascetic, it comes from a Greek word, a romanticized Greek word for exercise, actually training. It's a lifestyle characterized by abstinence from sensual pleasures and often for the purpose of pursuing spiritual goals. So I just love the depth of understanding just in these simple words that you may or may not have been exposed to in the Western world, reading this book for the first time, which many people do indeed do. So that's a sadhu. So you can kind of picture this sadhu comes in to see Yogananda's mother. And that would have been a striking appearance, even if it is a little bit more common to have sadhus roaming the land in India. Mike, there's a little bit just before we move on here, if you would kindly read on sadhu, if you have that ready.
Yeah. Sadhu means one who practices a sadhana or keenly follows a path of spiritual discipline. Although the vast majority of sadhus are yogis, not all yogis are sadhus. A sadhu's life is solely dedicated to achieving moksha, liberation from the cycle of death and rebirth, the fourth and final ashrama stage of life, through meditation and contemplation of Brahman. Sadhus often wear simple clothing, such as saffron-colored clothing in Hinduism and white or nothing in Jainism, symbolizing their sannyasa, renunciation of worldly possessions. Very nice. And it's like a few episodes ago, we distinguished between, was it yogi and swami, right? And now we're doing yogi and sadhu. Very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Our vocabulary is growing. Yes.
It is. It is sage, sadhu, yogi, swami. It is amazing. How much you can learn if you really go into the details we are doing, which not many people do, to be fair. But it's a beautiful picture that paints, doesn't it? This saffron colored clothing individual coming in to give some prophecies, as it turns out, to Yogananda's mother. And certainly it sets the tone exactly for what we're about to go into. And his mother did say that the simple words that he insists that he is there to see, the mother of Mukunda, struck a profound chord within her. Mike, do you want to jump in?
I feel that's because when she had Mukunda and went to Lahiri Mahasha, he gave her that prophecy about him, right? That your son will be a yogi, that your son will be a spiritual engine. I think we talked about it at length in the last episode. And now she feels a special responsibility, right? She feels like, I have this person who is so important to the world. I'm his mother. And when she hears that something is needed from her in that respect, she feels that this is very important. That's why I feel like it struck a chord for her. And that's maybe it's also something she has been waiting for to do those kind of things.
No, if my mother, regardless of if anybody told me that I was, told her that I was going to be a prophet or, whatever, if somebody had to come and said, I'm here to see the mother of Chris, that she would probably feel pretty like, you know, what's wrong? You know, what has he done? Like, more negative than positive, right? Any mother that is summoned that in some way, or somebody insists to see them, it's by the link that, you know, it's about their son. It probably does strike, you know, fear in the heart of somebody. But she doesn't describe it as that, obviously, but she described it as a profound chord. And my musings on it really is that, you know, this concept of time is such that it's maybe linear to our minds, but maybe in reality it isn't such. And this profound chord is something that maybe she expected, something similar to what you were saying, Mike.
I think you're right. And also, she is a person, we will also see that later, someone very in tune with God's will and cares about that. She has like a very spiritual understanding of life and her role in this. And so it also, I think it also comes from there.
So here we have this great sadhu, great colorful character. You know, if you saw that a sadhu walking down the street in London or something, you know, it would certainly stand out, wouldn't it? But here he is coming to Yogananda's mother with a message, and she immediately goes and bows at his feet, and that she sensed that the man in front of her was a true man of God. Now, bowing at one's feet is a practice that is more common for saintly figures, certainly in India, but it is not common elsewhere, let's say in the Western world, right? So this is something that maybe is almost like a muscle memory, I'm sure, to some who are devotees of some saints and things like this. And Yogananda himself is, you know, done this, and it's a common practice, right? But Mike, do you want to jump in on this?
Yeah, two things. First of all, yes, you're right. So I think it's very customary in India. If you address a Swami, you first bow down to them, touch their feet. And it's when Westerners come to wise ass ashrams, for example, that's like, I don't think you do it usually, but you see all the other people doing it. So and I feel like when Indians come to the West, I feel like some of them have the inclination of bowing down, because it's like you said, it's very customary. One thing that struck me here was that she sensed that in front of her was a true man of God. That like means that she had like some real intuition, some really she was really guided by God, because that is something that a normal person would not be able to do, right? Like, not, if a strange sadhu knocks on your door, you would be like, get lost. Or yeah, maybe you'd be nice to him, but you wouldn't know just by seeing him. Like, there's so many stories, right, where sadhus appear, especially in Indian mythology, and people don't know that they are perfectly realized. And she just does it without any strain.
I feel like there is also some relatability in it, though, because I don't know about you, but when you're in the presence of someone who has divine qualities, you feel it. And maybe it's one of those things where instantaneously she just knew. And maybe we would, if we were in the presence of a great one, you would know. Like, imagine if Guruji was there and you'd never met him before, you would know. I mean, most likely that he was, you know, divine. So maybe there's something in there that's for all of us, you know. What do you think, Chris?
You would hope you would know.
You would hope.
In some sense. And I think it's more mechanical in a sense, where this is somebody who lived a life of yoga, who didn't just go to practice on a Tuesday and then kind of went back to like a worldly life of sensory indulgence, right? She really lived that life. She was initiated into Kriya. We know she was very spiritually advanced. And I think the more we do that work, everything else takes care of itself. You know, I'd say I would hope in jest, right? Because essentially, if you've done the work, it's a capability that is innate within all of us, is how I see it, essentially, if you're doing this work. Guruji talks about this, you know, he is in the presence of many saintly people, and he, you know, says that he senses their great devotion and senses that they're really, truly a person of God. Even there's a great story that we'll get into in a later chapter where he goes into the bedroom of a saintly woman. And before he goes in, and she's there, it's the lady who manifests Christ, the sacrifice.
Therese Neumann.
Neumann. Thank you. Thank you very much. And he actually, I think in that story, he prepares himself, attunes himself, kind of gears in, you know, into this meditative state of sorts before he kind of enters. Then he's able to attune in with the vision, with the sights that she sees, things like this. So I think we can prepare ourselves for that. But if you're living that every single day, you're going to be more prepared to be able to recognize saintliness in others.
And it might be that the sadhu also wanted to be recognized as a messenger of God in some way. Mm-hmm. But we have seen some, like earlier in the previous chapter, we saw that Lahiri Mahashaya performed this miracle of not appearing on the photograph, basically to the effect that the person trying to photograph him realizing his divine nature, right? But otherwise he wouldn't have. Otherwise he would have just said, oh yeah, there's this guy, I'll just take a picture of him without even asking him. And and so sometimes people need miracles to actually accept that someone is a saint, and she had just this understanding, like, oh yeah, he's at the door, okay. I feel like, and maybe it's also because he asked her about Mukunda, maybe that also was something that she was kind of felt, oh yeah, this is God talking to me now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she maybe had that anticipation, she maybe had that intuitive awareness and that knowledge, that knowing, sense of knowing. But I love, there's two things, there's two prophecies essentially that the sadhu gives to her. And the first one, he addresses her, I love this, he addresses her as mother. Now, I made a note to myself, like, is this common? Because I don't live in India, and I'm not completely familiar with the culture there. It may be familiar to show respect, especially if he's trying to deliver a message, a divine message. So maybe there's something more akin there, but I don't know. Mike, do you have anything for us on this or no?
It could be that it's customary. I wouldn't know. We need Priyank in this. I also wonder what kind of word to use in Hindi, if he said ma or something like that. And if that's towards her actually being a mother, or is it her being a woman? I'm not sure. And we have to remember that also Lahiri Mahashaya called her little mother, right? So maybe it is something that is customary.
Yeah, I get divine mother. So that's where my mind went with it as well. I'd be keen to hear if the listeners have anything to say on that. So the message, the first prophecy essentially is, unfortunately, or rather not unfortunately, we use these words so frivolously, really. But the reality is that she wasn't going to live past her next illness. So that the stay on earth shall not be long, are his words. And her reaction is super interesting, that she felt there was silence. And as it goes on, it looks like the sadhu purposefully left that silence. He didn't rush into the next thing that you're trying to say, even though it's a monumentous prophecy again that he was to make. So there's a real significance to this, that they both sat in the silence together. And she said she felt no alarm, only a vibration of great peace. Such a beautiful moment. No, so beautiful. And we can break this down in many different ways. Before we do, Mike, jump in.
That's a super significant sentence. When I read that, like if somebody comes up to me and says, oh, by the way, you can die soon, I would not take it that well, I think. I would be devastated, I guess. And then she's not. She is, it even brings a vibration of peace to her. Like maybe she knew all along, or maybe she is just so in tune with God's will that she feels I come on this earth. So she's super aware what she is, that she is in this human form, but she's a soul and she incarnated and she has a few roles, a few things to do, a few tasks. And when those tasks are over, then she's done here. So she doesn't have a strong attachment to her life because just to live it, she just has a list of things to do, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's a really great take on it. That's something that I thought myself is, it's a confirmation that she's doing the right thing in a sense with her life, you know, like this peacefulness. That's, you know, whenever I think about like getting too excited or getting too animated or something, it's, you're probably going away from the peace that you get when you commune with God in some sense. So there's excitement is probably a bit overstated in everyday life, and really peace is probably where the fun's at, where the joy is at in some sense, like that inner silence, that inner peace, that communion with God. And she feels that here, and it's such a beautiful moment where she gets this potentially devastating news that she has faith, I suppose, because she's not told, as we know, what's going to come in this next part. You know, she's still got a really big part to play in Yogananda's life and delivering something to him. I don't know why I'm thinking I'm going to give a spoiler when, you know, everybody knows that, you know, delivering an amulet is all the title of the chapter. So she's still got this great part to play, but she doesn't know this yet. So, you know, this is before she was told that she'll still have a big part to play. But sorry, I'll pause there, Lauren. Do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight again about the peace thing, because I feel like that's a really important indicator of where she's going to go next. You know, they say that peace is the first, or one of the first indicators, if you will, of God's presence. So imagine you're told that your body is going to leave this earth and you feel a great wave of peace. It's probably that moment where you realize, oh, I'm going home, you know? So for her, then it may have been even like a confirmation of, okay, liberation, the way I've been journeying through this life is actually coming to its unity, I'll say. I don't know if that is the right word. But yeah, so it must have been a really affirming moment for her to have felt that way.
In the last episode, I shared a little bit of an insight into some personal story. And I can kind of expand on that. So last episode, I was talking about my wife and how I was praying to meet somebody. And ultimately, you know, I did. And now we're married. But when I proposed, I felt this vibration of peace. I felt a vibration of peace, sorry, I should say. And it's funny, I was talking to one of my best mates and his wife, and my wife was asking her, like, oh, so how did you feel when you were proposed to? And she said the same thing spontaneously. She said, yeah, like I felt just pure peace. And I thought, oh, that's a lovely coincidence, isn't it? Like this feeling of peace that we both couples kind of felt in that moment, where you're committing to a divine partnership or relationship, to commit to each other. And then you get this sense of peace. I thought it was something to share. You know, if you're lucky to have these little moments throughout your life, that was one that I was lucky enough to have. But obviously, much different circumstances to what Yogananda's mother's experiencing that. So certainly kudos and speaks volumes to her level of advancement.
Tip of the hat, right?
But I think it's a lovely add into the book, because these things, you know, there's so many things Yogananda is probably filtering, right? And he's including this for us to take learnings from that. But yeah, kudos to the mother. She's got it done. So just before this, actually, the sadhu says the great masters wish you to know. And the great masters wish you to know. Who are the great masters? Who could she be referring to? Now, the obvious answer to my mind is, well, the gurus, you know, the Hirdmarshaya, her guru, right? He's maybe waiting there. You know, we are told that our guru is it's multiple lifetimes of a relationship. It's beyond this physical life. Our guru is there to take care of us. And Priyanka actually said that for most people who don't have a guru, going into real heavy preparations for when you do pass is even more important to those who don't have a guru, because the guru is going to be there working with you to make sure that transition from death into the, say, after death is smooth, is easy. So we're blessed to have that relationship, and these great masters that we have, you know, the SRF masters, maybe they're all there, kind of, hopefully, I hope, to, you know, watching out over all of us, all the devotees. Mike, what's your take on it?
So first, I think her guru would be Lahir Mahashaya. So, but then also, we said that before, that Guruji is a bit humble with who his parents really are, especially his mother, because from the glimpses that we get from her, she's probably this really great saint. And she might have been, the way I imagined it, like Lahir Mahashaya and Babaji, they were like sitting in a circle there, plotting this whole thing. And she was also probably one of the people sitting there and saying, I'll play the role of the mom.
It's like, yeah, okay, me.
That's my hot take here.
Nice. I like it a lot. Yeah. So we have a footnote. I'm trying to say, check where is the footnote, but I think I'm pretty sure the footnote here. Yeah. So it's just after your next illness should prove to be your last, number 4, footnote 4. And this is really Yogananda's realization that the mother's, hastened plans for Ananta's wedding because of what's about to come, you know, what we're about to learn in this next prophecy. So the next illness shall prove to be your last. Okay, so she's now thinking, well, you know, my eldest son is due to get married. Before I leave this earth, I want to see that. You know, that's something she's pushing for. So Yogananda there in a really lovely footnote, reflecting on the reality of this. And he didn't know, obviously, until later, after she did pass, that this was the case. And this would have been one of the motivations that she was really pushing. She was really heavily involved, as she would have been anyway, but even more so. Yeah, sorry, Mike.
And as we read before, she would choose the bride for him. She, as we also know, wouldn't make it for the wedding, but he eventually marries that girl, right? That same girl. So she kind of, I guess it's the last thing on her list that she still needs to do, and she ticked it off.
Yeah. Yeah, I think part of me thought to myself, well, if she's really stricken with desire, it's probably not an amazing thing. You know, if you have these worldly desires, you probably don't want them. But I'm sure the great masters were helping her, you know, or maybe she was able to witness, because we do know in stories of Mejda that they actually did talk after death, the mother with Guruji, which was super, super fascinating, not included in the autobiography of a yogi. Too scary for most readers. That's a whole other story. So this second prophecy then, what is it? The continuation here is that, you know, finally he addressed me again. So we had this long pause. We don't know how long, but we have this pause where the first bit of information that he gives her is your silence. This vibration of peace is there. Maybe the sadhu also had a part to play in delivering that news to her. He was a true man of God after all. So maybe that vibration of peace that emanates from him really helped influence that as well. So he goes on to say that she's going to be this custodian of a silver amulet, and that he wasn't going to give it to her then. It would materialize in her hands the next day as she meditated. And he actually gives her strict instructions here that it's actually on her deathbed that it's the eldest son Ananta that she would have to instruct to then give to Yogananda, the second son. So and it would be for a whole year afterwards. So he really does give her these instructions, and as we know, the instructions were followed through almost precisely. Ananta kind of slipped a little bit, but we can forgive him for that. Before I go on, Mike, do you want to jump in?
Two things. So one, it might have been also some confirmation for who this person really is to her, that he knew so much about her family without ever having met them, right? He said, he came in and said about Mukunda, which is the name of her son. And then he later talks about Ananta, her oldest son, without probably ever having met any of them. but he knew exactly who they, her relationship to them, and when to do what.
It's a really good observation. I didn't even think about that, but it would have been quite weird if, you know. Yeah. He does come in with the credentials of knowing, certainly. Really good observation there, Mike. So I thought to myself, okay, well, you know, we talked about this maybe a little bit in the last episode, but you know, why her? It's a great honor, isn't it, to be a custodian of the amulet? And I thought, well, could he not have maybe given the message to Ananta after all? You know, could he given it to Bhagavati, his father, who Yogananda had a good relationship with also? Why her? Mike, give us the answer.
I will make some comment on this. So I feel like Ananta played this role because it helped him in his own development. That's what I'm gonna say. And then he didn't actually say, did he actually say 1 year, or did he say when Mukunda is ready to abandon all worldly desires? Because he said both. Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe the 14 months were actually because of the latter. I'm not sure. But that could be one explanation why it happened later.
But the mother, I was saying why the mother. So for me, I'll say why I think the mother. Yogananda's relationship with his mother was pure.
Mm.
And it was this pure love that he had with his mother and she for him. And I think that bond that we know after her death really shook him to his core. And he was crying out to the heavens, you know, demanding an answer as to why God took his mother from him. That really drove him immensely, didn't it? So there's that really strong connection there. And I think that in its essence is probably why her. What do you think, guys? Mike?
I think you're right. I actually didn't think of that in that way. But he does mention later that her deep brown eyes kind of were solacing for him in so many times in his childhood, right? And And then the only thing that could replace that later on was the love for Divine Mother, right? So you're right, Chris. She did play this role, and they had this really strong connection. And she was maybe before he had developed this love for God, she was kind of maybe like a kind of relay point for that. And probably she was the strongest spiritual influence he had in his childhood.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think, and I have this feeling that his bond was with his mother, because it was so strong, she was the person that had to leave her body first on this earth for him. Because if she didn't leave her body, then he perhaps would not have had that strong relationship with Divine Mother. It was really enhanced, wasn't it, by his mother's death. And then to hear this prophecy coming from the lips of his birth mother, I don't know, perhaps it was again that divine sign, you know, for him that was really like hitting to his heart. Because if it had come from his brother or his father, perhaps it wouldn't have quite hit home as much. I don't know, but it is it's an interesting one to ponder on, I feel.
Mike, jump in.
And I'm not sure if that's a reason, but maybe it also makes him more relatable in times that we are in, where oftentimes people grow up, and if he would have grown up with those perfect parents, perfect family situation, maybe it made him more relatable that he had to go through this in his childhood, and that he felt this pain. It's just a thought.
So before we continue, what is an amulet? What are we even talking about? We're all assuming, nodding our heads. Yes, we know what
I'm sure most of us asked that question when we read the book. What is an amulet?
What is an amulet? And for those people, especially, you know, we're talking about a divine amulet. Essentially, in this sense, we're talking about something that can be worn, over the neck, or I believe over the wrist as well, but you can wear it there. And really, the amulet itself, as also described here, as a talisman that shall materialize, is really there to act as a protection. And it's something that is to protect you from wrongdoing, from evil, from anything, any bad that might be able to happen to you. And it's given by a blessing by God, or by one of God's messengers. So that is essentially what we're talking about here, when they're saying that they'll receive a certain amulet. Sorry, Mike.
When I think of amulets, it's when I was little, I read the book The Neverending Story, and that's kind of what I always think of. He has this amulet called the Orin, and it fulfills all his wishes. And that's kind of what I was thinking about. It's something you wear around your neck, and it's like a lucky charm kind of thing. That's the picture that I always get when I think of amulet.
Yeah, it's exactly a charm against evil or injury, as defined online. I think Wikipedia gave me that one. So it's any object, a talisman is any object that is ascribed with religious or magical powers intended to protect, heal, or harm individuals for whom they're made. So it can act as a good or bad thing, depending on how it's made, how it's put together. I'm sure that is some real kind of occult magic going on there at times as well. But okay, so we do know then that the amulet is being going to be given to the mother. He actually says, he goes on to say here, that Mukunda will understand the meaning of the talisman from the great ones. So I think a question in my mind was, is it saying that the talisman's from the great ones, or is it saying that the message, the meaning of the talisman will be given to him by the great ones? I guess the former, to my mind, or both, essentially yeah. both. You know, what do you think, Lauren?
I think both. I mean, it's all one, isn't it, really? It comes from, but it is also gifted as. So, yeah, for me, I feel both. In any sense, Mukunda would have known exactly what.
As he does, you know, yeah. quite readily go on to tell us in a couple of paragraphs down that he knows more about it than what he's even willing to share, which is frustrating for any kind of nut like me that wants to know everything about it. So really, you know, we talked about it there. Well, just to kind of cap this off, he should receive the amulet when he's ready to renounce all worldly hopes and to start his vital search for God. That's a really significant part in this story, and maybe speaks to a couple different things. One, what we were just saying about the mother passing is significant to Yogananda. And maybe a year later, Yogananda was maybe ready to receive this, ready to kind of heal and move on to some greater extent than what he was in that short time before. And if the mother's death, as Lauren, you said, that she maybe had to die first, that was his greatest tie to earth, was his love for his mother, this material kind of, this love for, you know, human-based love, isn't it? Which we know is more of a lesser love than the divine love for with God. But that was his tie. So maybe that tie had to go in some way. Maybe. My interpretation of it. So very, very important idea here, that is the vital search for God is ready to start in young Mukunda when he receives the amulet. And he says, you know, he'll have it for some years, and when it's served its purpose, it shall vanish. No matter what you do, where you keep it, it's going to vanish to whence it came. We could probably talk about a half an hour about the materializing and how these things actually work. I mean, that's a whole subject for a lifetime of study, maybe. But, you know, we'll just, I think, draw a line under that to say that all things are possible with God, really, to be able to manifest in this plane, manifest various forms through atoms and the mastery over them. Extremely, extremely interesting stuff there. Probably for me, actually, just now that I'm thinking about this, when I first read the autobiography of a yogi, this planted the seed of fascination within me to a great extent, that I thought that the intuitive knowing within me said, yes, this is true. And that, hey, there's so much more to life. Like, this is great. You know, this is a great life. You know, should be really interested and fascinated. And it really led me, you know, one of those many things that led me down the path of yoga was the fascination and love for life, and you know, these magical things that happen are, you know, they're incredible, and they're to be appreciated for the wonder that we're all sharing in that is life. So it was a really significant moment, actually, for me when I read this. So the next paragraph, moving on, is that Yogananda's mother proffered, as it says here, alms to the saint. So she again bowed before him. And I thought, kind of funny, that Sadhu didn't accept the offering, but he did depart with a blessing.
Yeah.
Now, to go back to this, is why I kind of wanted to really define what Sadhu is. It's, you know, somebody who really renounces all sense, you know, sensory activity, and they tend to live off the charity of others, food, money, whatever it might be. So this is alms, essentially. This is what they mean by alms here. Like, it could be pretty much anything that might be of use to the saint, to the sadhu. But he doesn't accept it. And I thought, kind of funny. He's, no, I'm not here for your alms. I'm not here for your money, for your food. I'm here to deliver a message and I'm going to leave. And he comes and goes quite quickly, but Mike.
Yeah, I wonder about his, how should I put this, how his life on Earth, if he was even a permanent member of this planet, or if he maybe just was someone who materialized to play this role. Guruji describes him as the strange sadhu, right? Or he's described as that in the story. Or the servant does. Okay. But Guruji echoes that as well. So he might have been someone who has absolutely no use for any worldly things, or he might return to his cave in the Himalayas where the alms wouldn't help him either, and might not be someone who needs food or anything like that. So, but he when he says he did leave with a blessing, kind of means he did appreciate the alms, but he was just not in need of them.
Yeah, and the topic of blessings is interesting. And I thought it's something that is so in Christianity, you know, saints, the monks, the priests, you know, the people give blessings, you know, they tend to hold their hands up and say a prayer. They, you know, they might put their hands together, say a prayer, they might try to bless you that way. So it's quite a common concept, I think, in the Western world. But it's something you could easily roll over and kind of not realize the significance of it. But it really is defined as a favor of a gift or a gift bestowed by God. So that's the kind of strict definition, thereby bringing happiness or invoking of God's favor upon a person. And in that sense, everything's really a blessing that really comes from God. Everything kind of directly comes from God. Life is a blessing. We do have a recording that we can play. There's so much out there. But what I thought was, okay, a blessing. This is quite a physical presence. You've got sadhu there. Maybe we don't know the description, but maybe he's departing with a blessing. He's maybe raising his hands. He's maybe, you know, putting his hands on the head, or he's doing something where he's physically there. But as we don't have our guru in physical form, you know, with us, we have this concept actually that I wanted to bring today, which is that we still have our guru's blessing, even though it's not in the physical form. We don't need somebody, you know, a physical individual to hold hands up to actually give us that blessing. We receive it, as Priyank's talked about, with Babaji, even reciting the name in a chant of Babaji, Babaji, Babaji. We're receiving blessings just by having the presence of Babaji in our minds. So, Mike, you're able to play a recording now. Just as a heads up to people, this is a recording found on the website, on the official website, that you can find there. It's a clip of attuning our lives to Guruji's blessings, Sri Dayamata, sharing a personal experience as a witness of an event with Yogananda. And we can play, it's a couple of minutes. So do check it out online. If you want to hear more about this, go onto the bookstore of the yoganandasrf.org site. But Mike's going to play the little clip for us.
Yes, I will do.
We are, each one of us, so blessed. I think of it as the years roll by and as I get older in this work, I realize more than ever the greatness of Master. And then I am brought again back to his words one day when he was walking out to his porch to exercise, and I was following him. And he turned around quietly and shook his finger like this and said so sweetly, not with any egotism, Master was devoid of egotism, "When I am gone, the world will know what I am." And when he said it, my mind was conscious of the word am, and I thought to myself, he said that in that way for a reason. I don't understand what he meant now, but someday we will understand. When I am gone, the world will know what I am. He could have said, the world will know what I was. It was correct grammar. The world will know what I am. And how many times I think that message of his, and think, indeed, Master, the more I grow on this path, the more I strive to find God on this path, the more I realize what you are. You are not an ordinary being, but you are indeed the truest and the purest reflection of that divine which it has been my privilege, and which it will be the privilege of this present age to behold. Indeed, it makes me feel most unworthy to strive to follow in the footsteps of that blessed Guru. But I can only say one thing to you, as I have said again and again in India to the devotees. Only one thing that is real to me in this life, instilled in my heart and consciousness by that divine Guru. Love, love, love. Divine love, divine love.
Well, it's awesome. Actually makes me very emotional listening to that. Brings tears to my eyes. So powerful. So blessings, topic of blessings again. How long do we have? We could talk about this all day, I think, but really we're receiving them all the time from our guru, from not just in this physical form, but he's there with us when we think of him near. Mike?
Yeah, don't want to know where I would be if it wasn't for his blessings. And Dharma just has this way of expressing her love and appreciation for the guru. Like I feel no one else can. Like, it's like you said, Chris, it's just that the vibe, the mood in the room just changed, didn't it?
Yeah. Grounded in a heartfelt center. Yeah. So good. So good. So hope you enjoyed that. So we have, sorry, Lauren, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I definitely feel that you're right, Chris. You know, like, blessings are everywhere. And I feel like it's really important for us to remember that even the difficult things are blessings too. It's easy to feel blessed when things are going really, really well for you. And, you know, you're feeling peaceful and loved or hashtag whatever. Blessed. Yeah, do you know, but actually everything in life is a blessing from God and gurus, you know. So we're very, very blessed indeed, aren't we, really? Mm.
I'll remind you of that next time you stub your toe, Lauren. I'm
kidding. Do you know, when a physical thing happens, I'm like, oh, karma.
All right.
Same yeah. Here. Like, oh, yeah. Okay. That one's played out. Okay.
Yeah. I actually did hurt myself this time last week, and I've been out of action for a week with some of the sports that I play. And I thought, oh, it's karma for something. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, to say thanks.
Yeah.
Move on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Sorry, Mike. Go on.
Yeah, that's a famous prayer by Sri Gyanamata, right? Like, don't change any circumstance in my life. Mm. Change me. Mm. And that's what you guys just expressed. So That's a really good way to see the world.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Be a lot less hurt in the world, wouldn't her? So the next evening she was sitting there, and this she's folded hands meditation, and yes, it materialized. So she had any doubt, which I don't think she had, it would have been gone by this point. How would I have reacted if something had materialized? Is something you maybe it was made popular in Star Trek, you know, the materializing of the food in the canteen, you know, that's, you know, materializing humans back and forth from locations. Maybe that is our future.
The best part, the dematerialization of the dirty dishes. That's perfect.
The dirty You see, I don't mind the dirty dishes. I don't mind them. It's a yoga practice. You're cleaning the karma. You're scrubbing that karma off with every stroke.
Yeah. I agree. I quite like doing the dishes too, but I feel like when I start doing them, my guests always feel like I want them to leave. It's like my cue. Yeah, yeah.
Meanwhile, you're just in your happy place. Like,
yeah.
Same here. Barbara, My wife, she cooks, I clean. So thank goodness I enjoy the cleaning because, I do it every day. Alrighty. She's obviously deeply spiritually advanced and isn't fazed at all by this materializing of a silver amulet. It's a great description here. It made itself known by a cold, smooth touch. She jealously guarded it for more than 2 years. So we have a timeline, and hence this is where we have a correction to make. Last episode, for those paying attention, and I love how this is a surprise for us.
It's just hit me now.
Last episode, we were musing and saying, okay, well, why did they wait that long between, getting the amulet and giving it to Yogananda? Why, it's risky. No, it was me, actually, that said it was risky, having waited until the deathbed, on the deathbed to give it. And I said it in my excitement in that moment, forgetting that we actually have this great, piece of information is exactly why this happened is that she was instructed to do so. She was instructed to wait till the deathbed. She was instructed to give it to the eldest brother. And she was instructed to tell him to wait for a year. So we have all the answers here. We were musing last episode for nothing, it seems. That's the correction. For any listeners out there, I wonder, because we record these ahead of time, will any listeners actually flag that to say, hey, Numpty, Chris, this is actually discussed in the episode that you're going to lead the next in the next part of the book. Anyway, Lauren.
I've also just realized that this means that she knew for 2 years that she was going to die in her next illness. She was going to leave her body, I should say, in her next illness. That's a long time, like 2 years, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't like a common cold. she's sneezing like, is this the time? It's a serious illness, right? And it hit her pretty quickly. And knowing now this story, she had manifested herself in a vision to Yogananda. She tried to get Yogananda to come see her. This is all she was pushing for, this wedding, because she was concerned, like, I might not have a lot of time if my it's they say here that it's going to be a short amount of time. It's all comes together, doesn't it, in these few paragraphs. So that's the correction. Maybe the eagle-eyed or the keen listeners have already corrected us, and we're recording this ahead of time, so we can go back and look to see.
We're yelling at the screen.
Exactly. Yeah.
like no.
Shaking the laptop.
You're wrong.
Yes. So here she is. She's not surprised that the amulet manifests itself, materializes there. She guards it for 2 years, and I thought to myself, gosh, where would she have kept this amulet for 2 years with a bunch of kids running around, opening things and curious, like looking in every wardrobe and door, like I wonder where she kept it for 2 years. But there she does a very good job, obviously. We don't have any record of anybody discovering this amulet. Anyway, Lauren.
I also find it really interesting how she says, I have jealously guarded it for more than 2 years. Mm. It's a real indicator of like some little humanness that's remaining perhaps within her, or something else. I wonder what our listeners feel about that too. I kind of, it makes me, I don't know, it makes me smile a little bit. It feels kind of like a light-hearted jealousy rather than something more severe. But yeah, that's quite interesting. What do you feel, Mike?
Yeah, I was just gonna bring up the word jealous as well. And it has a bit of a negative connotation, I feel like, but maybe in this sense it doesn't. It's like a fierceness of how she was guarding it, right? Like really trying to fulfill her spiritual mission that she has. Maybe it's meant in that way. And like you said, listeners, if you have any ideas on this, please share it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't even occur to me that there was a negative connotation to it, which is curious, because I think the interpretation to my mind is one of fervor. She guarded it, you know, with real, a real strong kind of passion. And she clearly had this amazing experience, right? You know, it's something that was so significant. Imagine if something materialized in your hands. It's incredible. You know, if she ever needed a confirmation or if she ever had any doubt, it's gone. You know, this is, you know, her mission was to do this. So she would have been steadfast, you know, I'm sure beyond any doubt that she was to keep this promise, I suppose she would have maybe invisibly made. She follows up here, probably again, Priyank's mentioned a couple of times about the romanticism that we see in the words have in the autobiography of a yogi. And for me, it really moved me to read the next part where she said, this is a message that she gave through Ananta to Yogananda. And of course, Ananta would have benefited from this as well. He was the eldest son, right? But she said, do not grieve for me as I shall have been ushered by my great guru into the arms of the infinite. Farewell, my child. The cosmic mother will protect you. It really moves me, that statement. Huh? The divine love, commitment, the faith, the joy, you know, she's on her deathbed, right? This isn't a happy moment for her anyway. It's obviously something that she's suffering, her body's suffering at very least, but she's there with God still on her deathbed. Really, really beautiful moment for me. But Mike, do you want to comment?
And if we haven't picked up on it yet, I would say this again, those are the words of a saint, right? This is how a saint leaves the earth. And I said earlier that Guruji is very good at like calling all the people saints that appear in his life, but he's very humble with his parents, with his mother. He wouldn't say that there, but I guess that's how I would interpret it, that she incarnated as a fully realized soul and did this as a seva to Guruji, this incarnation. Mm-hmm. And Lahiri Mahashaya and the other great masters are waiting for her on the other side.
And she also like passes her son to the Divine Mother as well, which is so beautiful. You know, that is divine love, isn't it, right there? Just saying, you know, Cosmic Mother will protect you. It's out of my astral hands now, or whatever you want to call it.
My physical, yeah.
Yeah, that's the word. Yeah. Yes. Mike?
Yeah. I had a section from Metta that I wanted to read out. It's because in the book Metta, this whole section with the letter is very similar to the autobiography. But then at the end of it, he adds another paragraph that I found telling, and I'm just going to read it out. It's very short. It says, on learning how Lahiri Mahashaya had blessed Mejda and predicted his spiritual destiny, I understood why Mother had so carefully made for him the image of the Mother Kali when we were living in Gorakhpur. She felt it her divine duty to nurture his every spiritual inclination. And I guess that was probably her main goal in this life as Mother of Yogananda.
I wonder what you guys think of, you're writing this book as Yogananda. You have a wealth of information to include into it. You probably could have wrote, you know, a double volume, you know, at least, right, book. I wonder, did that a little bit there actually made it in, but it was drafted out, you know, it made it into the draft, but it was brought out. It seems like maybe something that, you know, when you're drafting, kind of improving slowly, 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 trying to improve the impactfulness of every paragraph, every sentence. Like we have this Imagda. It just occurred to me, like maybe this was in the autobiography of a yogi initially, but it was drafted out or something. I don't know why it occurred to me, possibly complete musings, but thankfully we have it in Imagda to add color, even more color to the story. That's already amazingly colorful enough for us.
You could probably write a whole book about Yogananda's mother, about her life. Oh. It would probably be super interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Alrighty. So we have the second prophecy, and that was the second prophecy. Now to move on to the Yogananda's response to this amulet. I barely even know where to start with this, to be honest, because, you know, probably at the first three or four words is a good place to start. But a blaze of illumination is how he starts this paragraph. And again, it's something to my mind, something I envisage something. But it's easy to think, well, what, you know, to not think about what actually do the other people envisage when they read this for the first time. And to me, the way I envisage it is illumination, a blaze of light, essentially, came over him, Yogananda, with the possession of the amulet, and dormant memories awakened. Now, whenever I think of this, is I see Yogananda and his eyes almost glazed over, because he's actually seeing more astral lights. He's seeing something different. That's how I envisage this whenever I read this, where he's in this physical form, but this blaze of illumination, this divine light almost reveals itself to him, hidden behind this veil of Maya that we see every day. That's sort of how I envisage it. Maybe I wondered how you guys envisaged it. Is it any different, same?
Yeah, mine was quite different. I imagined it as more of a soul intuitive illumination. But I suppose actually hearing yours and reflecting on how I also perceived it, perhaps we perceive this illumination as to how we, our relationship is with the divine, you know, what aspects really draw you in, perhaps. You know, we see the world as we are, don't we? Or as we think we are. It must have been, you can't even imagine that experience, really, can you? Well, perhaps you can if you've been through it.
I tried to, that's the purpose of the exercise. Like whenever I think about it, it's almost like a daydream. I could be looking over here, but I don't actually see what I'm looking at, because I'm so enwrapped in my mind's eye. But I think you're quite right, Lauren. I would say maybe in both ways, essentially, it's this intuitive knowing, this intuitive sense. Mike, what's your take?
This is a massively spiritually charged object, this amulet, right? And the only thing that's a bit of a bummer is that it dematerialized. So it was basically created with an expiration date, and then it would dematerialize, because otherwise this would be something like the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant. It would be like a big thing that, I don't know, wherever this would be, you would feel the vibration of it. And I would love to know more about this. There's a bit more about this in the footnote, where he says that it carried an inscription in Sanskrit, right? And then when you pronounce it correctly, it would positively stimulate in a spiritual way. I would love to hold that thing in my hand for a bit and and as he gets it, he, when it says blaze of illumination, I feel it must have been a spiritual experience. So if you would have made a movie, it would have probably been like you get the amulet and suddenly you're not on Earth anymore. You're in this in this other world, right? And have a big spiritual experience. So that's my take.
Yeah. The truth may be somewhere in between or not at all. It would be great to get this minute detail, but that's probably greedy of me. It's not necessary. But he does mention dormant memories awakened. Now, this is something that he's talked about before, where maybe his brother was chastising him about a robe, and that struck a chord with him to say, oh, wow, you know, he sort of alludes to, you know, this kind of aroused, I can't remember exactly how I said it, memories of a past life where he would have worn it, or he was imagining, he was, you know, struck his imagination that this would be something that he would be well suited to. But he does talk about past lives, and this is dormant memories awakened. So an extremely powerful object. He does describe it here as the talisman is round, anciently quaint, which I thought was quite a telling description, and was covered in Sanskrit characters. And that, you know, I wondered, was this something that one of the great gurus, Babaji, or, you know, we don't see them wearing amulets, you know, we don't see something around their necks necessarily, but maybe elsewhere, maybe they have amulets. Maybe this is like a token that they hold close to their heart that they want to give, because Yogananda is yet with the guru, you know, he yet has that guru physically in his life. And we'll go into this in a little bit more detail, but maybe it was actually somebody's, you know, one of the great gurus, it was actually one of their possessions in some ways, and they loaned it to him for a time. Mike?
Yeah, I would love to dwell on the amulet for for longer, because it's just, it's very mystical. And I don't really know what it means. And oftentimes when I read things in the autobiography of a yogi, I feel like the content is meant for people in higher ages. And maybe this is also one of those. Maybe in higher ages, it will become more normal to just materialize things. And Guruji, like you just hinted about that there were Sanskrit characters on the amulet. And that is, Guruji goes on and on in very lengthy footnotes about the importance of Sanskrit, about the power of the language, how it is the perfect language. And also, I think in one part it says that in the Encyclopedia Americana, it says that this has been the most significant discovery since the invention of classical learning, right? So it is vastly important that it is in Sanskrit, the inscription there. And I feel like, again, that it's super fascinating. When I first read about the amulet, I found it, okay, that's a nice story. But the more you go into it, the more you feel like, oh, this must have had a really big significance. And I wonder if that would ever be something that has a bigger significance in life in higher ages.
Musings for days. Yeah. And Sanskrit, like whatever, you know, I've done Google searches and read it, a couple of pages. Priyank is obviously a master. Again, I want to say I can't say he speaks Sanskrit. You're not allowed to. He sings. I can't remember what he does. What's the way to say it? Sorry, Priyank. We've messed up in two straight episodes, I think. But he knows Sanskrit, right? So he can recite it. I think that might be the better way to say it. And when I was reading about this, it was saying Sanskrit, it goes back to the Bronze Age, you know, 400-500 BC, but one of the more ancient first reports of it is actually in the Bhagavad Gita, which I thought was fascinating, because if that's the first the first kind of report that they have, like that's an established, well-formed, beautifully poetic use of that language. You know, it's not some rudimentary kind of, you know, English has gone through a couple of different versions, you know, it's evolving. It's, you know, it's there. It's older than what maybe we know. So the idea here is that we're told is that Yogananda understands. He says, "I understood that it came from the teachers of past lives who were invisibly guiding my steps." Now he doesn't say like my, you know, the gurus of self-realization fellowship, the great masters, as was described by the sadhu. But he says the teachers of past lives. So you could interpret this, you know, many different ways, I suppose, but teachers of past lives. We know that, you know, the yogis of the Himalayas have been mentioned, and that crops up again, and he yearns to be with them. And, you know, the relationship that he has with these, you know, with Babaji is very, very special, and so on and so forth. So who exactly he's referring to doesn't quite state, but that's on purpose, right? Otherwise, he would have given us that information. And he then says a further significance. there was, and I have to laugh every time I read this and think about this. He says, you know, and very poetically, he says, "But one may not fully unveil the heart of an amulet." Now, very poetic for me. And gosh, I wish I knew exactly what he was hinting at, but maybe we do have some hints that we can delve into here. So he says that the talisman eventually vanished amidst some deeply unhappy circumstances in his life. The loss of the amulet came at the time of a gain of a guru. Now we're going to go into this in more detail in future episodes, so let's not delve into it too much here, but it essentially came at the time when his guru came into his life. Now the guru, as we know, acts as a, in some ways, guider, you know, protector. The guru might give blessings and so on and so forth. So if the amulet is coincidentally dematerializing after, quote unquote, it served its purpose, as the sadhu says, are we to imagine that maybe either it is guided Guruji to the guru, or that it's actually acting as a guru might act in some ways to help guide and protect Yogananda and or from harm and so on. You could delve into this. My mind's just racing, but Mike, what's your take?
Love that idea. Yeah, I mean, you have to think, in his life, he had his mother, then he had one, or let's say 14 months of neither his mother, but then he had the amulet, right? And I love to think that the amulet was, like you just said, guiding him, and maybe it was the kind of thing that protected him of a lot of things. And like in one of those mystical stories, you know, where you have like this magical amulet and it pulls you in this direction, go over here. Yeah, like that.
It's like something out of Harry Potter. Yeah.
Yes, that exactly. And then when it vanished, there was his guru, right? So this was bridging a time where he had not his guru yet, but he had lost his mother, who was a spiritual guide up until then.
And he also writes after that, he says that he daily traveled far on the wings of his amulet. So it obviously took him so far, you know, like you say, it was like a guide in the journey to the herald of his guru, that sign that his guru was coming. And you know, He didn't need that amulet anymore, because behold, the fleshly form was on its way.
Yeah. It's like jump in.
And I wonder what he meant by traveling there, if he makes this word work really hard here, if it's maybe in his meditations or physical travel or his imagination or all of the above. Mm-hmm.
So we know throughout this chapter, he did attempt many times to go to the Himalayas. He was quite obsessed with the idea. He wanted to join the Himalayan yogis. And we talked about it maybe in last episode that really the amulet came to him at the time when he was ready to, you know, relinquish the worldly desires in some ways. Maybe that is, I don't know, is that more or less related to the Himalayas? Probably less. But he was ready essentially to completely attune himself to God's will. And that would have requires much sacrifice on Yogananda's part to go to America, you know, to go to the US, to leave the India. You know, it would have required much sacrifice on his part, really. We see here that he says the small boy thwarted in his attempts to reach the Himalayas till he traveled far in the wings of his amulet. So, you know, we'll go into it again in more detail, but Sri Yukteswar and others were saying, look, you don't need to go to the Himalayas. You know, you can be here to reach God and to do these things. So obviously the wings of the amulet were taking him closer to God. That's my interpretation of it. No matter how he was doing that, that's essentially my interpretation, because the Himalayas, as we know, they are manifestation or representation of God, essentially, to my mind. So, okay, that's the chapter. I hope you enjoyed the reflections and, you know, us going through, dear listeners and everything. Let's do a quick summary of this chapter, and then we're going to jump into some reflections, each of us, on what we liked, you know, what we discovered, what we might change, what we're looking forward to, these kind of things for the next chapter. So really, you know, this chapter, we begun by discussing the, you know, the preparations for Ananta's wedding and Yogananda's mother's desire to see the eldest son get married, Paramahansa Yogananda's vision of his mother and the ultimate tragedy of the passing, Yogananda's desires and attempts to flee the Himalayas, as we just said, and Ananta's chastising and thwarting of his plans, and the impact, of course, of his mother's death, and Ananta's admission of the delay in passing to Mukunda the message of the mother, but ultimately fulfilling that promise that he would have made, and the great story of Lahiri Mahasaya's spiritual blessing and prophecy by the sadhu. Lahiri Mahasaya's prophecy and the vision of the great light from Yogananda. So we had so many stories in there. Of course, yeah, in this episode, you know, we're talking about the retelling of the prophecies of the great sadhu and the amulet and much more, much, much more that we've talked about in the last four episodes. So for me, I'll start. What did I like? Gosh, everything. I don't think there's nothing that you don't like in this. So it's a long list of things that I like. I think for me, you know, it's a clear message. Yogananda has dedicated this whole chapter to his mother, to the significance of the role that she's had to play. For me, the takeaway is the love that he had for his mother, the divine love that they had for each other, the significance of that in an avatar's life, and what that means for us, like what takeaways we have within our lifetime. The deep dive that we've done, what I discovered really is the mystical nature of life again. I think we're going to go into it about in the next chapter about things manifesting and being mystical and so on and so forth, but this for me spurred so much fascination and imagination and my passion and love for life. It's such a beautiful story that we've been given, and then really something I might change for the next coverage of the chapter. I don't know. I think, you know, listener guidance on what they want covered would be actually really nice to start incorporating some listeners. So if you want to, as homework, go ahead to the next chapter and, you know, start reading, you probably have to go a whole chapter ahead. So go to, say, chapter 4 or even 5 and try to read some topics and try to pull something out. Maybe that's a suggestion I can say if you really want to be active and ahead of the curve. We record a few episodes ahead than what we release. And looking forward to the next chapter. There's an amazing amount of stuff to go through in the next chapter, of course. So, but I'll just leave it there because I know Lauren has a few things to say as well. So I'll pass over to you, Lauren, about reflections on this chapter.
So. You threw that at me right there. there was so much in this chapter, wasn't there? And for me, it just, even from chapter 1 up until 2, it feels like he's lived through so much. Like there's been so many lifetimes in that short period of time. And I don't know, it tickles me a little bit in a divine comedy kind of way, because I often say to people, in this past sort of, 5 years or so, I feel like I've lived so many lifetimes just in a short space of time. And I feel that relatability there with him. It feels like he's been through lots, but and so much has happened, and there's so much for us to take away from in each little paragraph, in each story that he tells. And again, it's like we're saying today, how we read it, how I read it is so different to how you read it, Chris, and how you read it, Mike, and we all take away our own little reflections and lessons from it. But it's definitely an affirmation, I think. I know it's definitely an affirmation for all of us that in the midst of real severe trials, it really is a blessing. And you can't discount God's hand wherever you are in life. Of course, it's much easier said than done, but I feel like the truth still remains, lots to take away for me from there. I'm really looking forward to delving into more of the book. It's such a treat, isn't it, to be able to go through it so deeply. And share it with you, you all and listeners, and we love to read your comments and things. And so, yeah, definitely have more discussions with us in the comments, because it is such a joy to read how you're perceiving the book too. And on that note, Mike, what do you feel? What do you think? How's it been for you?
So chapter 2 is like a real change of pace from chapter 1, because it just describes a bit how his family looks like and his life, and gets you into everything. And then chapter 2, I mean, you see how Guruji is very good at immersive storytelling. Like he gets you in, he makes you feel easy, and then boom, that's the first big thing happening. So where there's darkness, there's also light, right? So his mom passes away, but then he describes the beautiful moments he had with her, the beautiful connection he had with her, the dynamics between him and his family and Divine Mother and Lahiri Mahashaya, and how she saw him as this godlike child that she wanted to raise as good as she could. And when you deep dive in it, you notice that in the life of a divine one, every little detail is important. There's nothing happening that's insignificant, and we get to pick up on every little thing and think about it. And I love that. I find that super interesting, super fascinating. And I'm not sure, on the things we should change for the next chapter, I would actually again ask the listeners what they think. I love reading their comments, and this is really brings me joy that on the one hand we get to make a deep dive on this amazingly fascinating book, and on the other hand we get feedback all the time and a lot of positive ideas and a lot of very, very well-intended comments that I really appreciate. And I'm looking forward to the next chapter. And if you don't mind, Chris, I can tease it a little bit.
Go for it.
So he obviously, I mean, we are two chapters in and we've seen saints, we've seen miracles, we've seen magical amulets, if I may call it that. And so in the next chapter, we will see more of that. We will see the saint with two bodies who will perform a perfect miracle for us. And I love how Guruji just describes those stories without saying, oh yeah, this is like the greatest thing. He's like, oh yeah, so I met this guy and he is a saint and he can be in two places at the same time. And there's a lot of significance to him and also having a connection with Lahiri Mahashaya, because that seems to be a common thread in Guruji's life. And I feel that this chapter is going to be one of many in the beginning of the book where he describes his encounters with other saints until he meets his guru finally.
Nice. Alrighty, thanks guys. Thanks for that. And to the listeners, if you do want to get ahead with some homework, if Priyank was here, the disciplinarian would be giving you homework. So I'll do that for him. he would probably say, you know, read ahead. Well, I don't know what he would say. I'll say I would suggest to read ahead. I think maybe as homework, you know, take the first chapter. It starts, you know, Father, I promise to return home. We are going to aim. It's not set in stone, but we'll aim to cut it at the last sentence that said, he glanced at the letter and made a few affectionate references to my parent. We're probably going to stop up to there. So typically, you know, what we do is we try to go through, get talking points, and then expand on each and try to, you know, work through it bit by bit. If you want to go through and think, you know, yourself, what talking points would you have? You can join us on that endeavor and, you know, have fun that way and pull out bits that you think are interesting. And like I said, if we skip bits that you think are interesting or pull out and, you know, you want to flag those to us, please do. Or if you just want to go along for the journey and listen in and have fun that way, feel free as well. Don't worry about the homework. You may have enough on your plate as it is, but that's there optional for those who want to. I suppose just to recap then, we might actually do go back to what I said at the beginning. There's so much of a footnote, as Mike alluded to earlier, footnote number 6. It's like a whole coverage, a whole special episode we may do then, or we probably will do in a short time. So look out for that special episode and check it out. The footnote number 6, that's coming up next. So you can have a read at that as well. We're going to cover that in a separate episode in case you're wondering why didn't we go into that more detail. We will. We'll try to cover everything that we can. So with that said, anything else from you guys? Anything you'd want to go into before we call it a day for this episode?
No, that's everything. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you to everybody for joining us today. Jai Guru. Till next time.
Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.